much, Ron, and thanks for inviting me to join the panel. So I would just like to share with you some of what the current situation in India looks like in terms of government engagement and collaboration with private providers in the health sector. And just to start off with a couple of facts, I think this chart really tells a very straightforward story about the role of private healthcare providers in India. You can see from the top with immunizations and prenatal care, typical preventive public health services, institutional deliveries and hospitalization and outpatient care. The blue parts of the bars are the utilization of public sector, government-run providers. The red parts of the bars are the utilization of non-government private sector providers. This is national data. These are national averages. And, you know, quite simply, you can see that the government is overwhelmingly dominant in delivery of services like immunization, largely so in prenatal care, less so in institutional deliveries, less so, again, in hospitalizations, with about 40% of all hospital admissions being in public institutions, 60% in private. And in outpatient care, that's treatment of acute illness, about 20% of utilization is in government institutions and 80% in private institutions. So a very large role for private healthcare providers and a very different role depending on the kinds of services that we're interested in. Today, private providers are the dominant source of acute treatment for most diseases of public health importance. So it's important to distinguish between what I would call public health services and then problems of public health importance. There are public health services which attempt to prevent many of these diseases from occurring, but when people seek treatment, and in many of these cases, treatment is a source of secondary prevention, they typically go to private providers. So for tuberculosis, malaria, acute diarrheas, respiratory infections in children, sexually transmitted disease, and opportunistic infections associated with HIV/AIDS, it's largely acute care in the private sector. What's very important in India, however, is that much of this treatment, and we're not entirely sure statistically how much because of the way data is collected, is delivered by what I've called LTFQ providers. LTFQ stands for less than fully qualified. There are less charitable terms for these providers, but basically some of them are totally unqualified, dangerous quacks. That's the less charitable term that's often used. But some of them are not. Some of them are paramedical workers who have partial training, who may be under some kind of supervision or relationship with a qualified provider, but who deliver acute ambulatory care in the market. And they're a very important part of healthcare delivery in the private sector, especially in the poorer states of India. I've been in India for 3 years now, and it's my second time living there. I lived there in the late 1980s. And I got interested in the role of the private sector when I did my first tour in India, and that was because it was so obvious that they were a very important part of healthcare delivery, especially primary level healthcare delivery, and there seemed to be very little discussion about their role and what should be done as a result of their important role. And one thing I really have noticed in my return to India several years ago is that that situation has totally changed. Today, the facts that I have just shown you, which were largely either ignored or in some cases denied by official India, today these facts are widely reported and accepted. They are widely reported in government documents. They are accepted as a correct description of the state of play in India's health sector. And as a result of that, there's a tremendous amount of space that's opened up in official India for thinking about public-private partnerships. And this was not the case 20 years ago. So today, PPP is an accepted strategy. In most national health programs and many state programs, there's space. That is, there's officially acknowledged the importance and the potential for developing public-private partnerships. And that was not the case at all 20 years ago. This was not a subject that you raised in polite company with the government, because India was and still is officially committed to a national health service strategy. That is, government-funded, government-run healthcare facilities to provide basically free services for the population for just about everything that they need. That is still very much the formal official strategy, but there is now an acknowledgement that there's a tremendous role that the private sector can play in helping to achieve coverage and improve quality. So there's a lot going on, but if you look at the total space of healthcare, it's not clear that the government has filled that much of its space with public-private partnership, and there's still a lot of policy debate about whether this is a good idea. So it's a very exciting time right now, with increasing resources, increased attention to health outcomes, and an openness to work with the private sector. So let me just show you some examples of this. I don't think it's fully appreciated how much public-private partnership is actually going on in India today. The National AIDS Control Program is essentially run through a quasi-government society, which technically is a non-government organization, although government officials hold the senior positions in that society. Most of the prevention activities for HIV/AIDS treatment are contracted out to nonprofit organizations. As treatment of HIV/AIDS has become a larger part of the government's program, and it's still not a very large part of the government's program, that has tended to focus more on services to be delivered through government institutions, government hospitals primarily. But the AIDS Control Program is largely a program delivered through public-private partnerships. The National TB Control Program, which is delivering the DOTS intervention nationwide now, has a sizable public-private partnership for DOTS component, which is mainly working in urban areas where the government actually trains and finances private physicians to do case finding and treatment. And this is seen as a very successful intervention, and it's expanding. The National Reproductive and Child Health Program also makes use of public-private partnerships. Again, most of the non-salary expenditure in the program is administered through a quasi-government society, or not through a government department. There's widespread contracting of NGOs to support service delivery through what's called the Mother NGO Scheme, where large NGOs engage with smaller NGOs to provide services at the community level. There's a new program called JSY, Janani Suraksha Yojana, which is a cash transfer program that gives cash grants to pregnant women for antenatal care and institutional deliveries and provides an incentive for them to deliver in non-government health facilities. They receive these grants for deliveries in non-government health facilities. And there are ongoing immunization subsidies for private providers where vaccines and training and other things are given to private providers. The major new national program, the National Rural Health Mission, also includes a sizable component of flexible funding to states and districts, which explicitly lists contracting out and innovative partnerships with private providers as one of its core interventions, although to date this hasn't been very much used. It's a relatively new program. In the states, there's also a lot of innovation going on. There are a number of states which are contracting out health facilities, mostly to nonprofit organizations, but the experience has been quite mixed, and with very weak design of contracts and administration. There's contracting in of specialist staff to fill human resource gaps, particularly anesthesiologists, OBGYNs, and so on, and increasingly contracting in of nurses to fill gaps in lower-level facilities. A fair amount of contracting in of support services in health facilities, cleaning, diet, laundry, this kind of thing, in hospitals, and recently many more initiatives in areas like social franchising, vouchers, which include payment to private providers, and so on. So just taking stock of what the overall situation looks like, and these are my concluding comments, even though there is still some official concern and reluctance to look at PPP as a major health strategy, I think there is now space in almost all the major national programs for this to be part of what the government is doing. There's a lot going on, and the space opens up greater opportunities for doing more. And you would think, looking at the first slide I presented you, that the role of private providers in delivering healthcare, there really are tremendous opportunities for expanding access and coverage through public-private partnerships. One of the biggest gaps has been the less than fully qualified sector. There's very little effort to try to engage these less than fully qualified providers in public programs, mostly because of legal constraints. what they are doing, what these LTFQ providers do is illegal, and while the government, many people in the government would like to engage them, there's a fear that they will be vulnerable to legal action and accountability questions if they do so. So most of the PVP has been with the formal private sector, even though this LTFQ sector really is much larger than the formal private sector. So there are expanded financing for public health programs, but there is some concern that this tremendous increase in funding might in fact crowd out some of the energy for PPP, because government officials are being given more money to do, in a sense, what they know how to do best, which is to finance public sector delivery, and the skills and capacities to do PPP are in short supply. So as budgets increase, it might ironically actually reduce the amount of effort on public-private partnerships. There's been almost no serious impact evaluation of how these have worked, and so we're often dealing with anecdotal information and trying to make the best of a weak information environment, and little learning across these programs between the center and states. So overall, it's a picture of much greater interest and potential than we had in the past, but there are some constraints to doing more, and still some reluctance to see working with the private sector as a key component of India's health system strategies to improve outcomes.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
That was an absolutely terrific presentation. I just came back from India a couple of weeks ago for the first time I'd ever spent any time in India, and I learned some things during this presentation I didn't learn in a week there. But he's absolutely right to pinpoint India as a remarkable example of where these public-private partnerships can really work. In fact, I'll say a little bit about it in my comments. I want to begin, though, with putting this in just a little bit of a context for you. You can't talk about public-private partnerships without first addressing the question of what's happened, particularly since 2001, in foreign assistance in general. And I think one of the things that most of you know, I suspect, is there's been a huge increase in foreign assistance in terms of the amount of taxpayer dollars that's going into development in general. We're talking about basically a tripling since 2001 to 2005, $28.5 billion in the category of what's called official development assistance. That doesn't even include the fact that the United States government contributed about $2.2 billion to international organizations, the UN, World Bank, Global Health Fund, et cetera. So there's a lot more money than in the past going into development. If that's also true with respect to health programs, maybe particularly true with respect to health programs, because there are probably no programs that are development connected with the Congress that are more popular than health programs. Democratic and Republican requests to Congress are routinely raised when it has to do with health. You would think the administrations would get the picture that the Congress is much more open to this. In fact, I've heard it said that sometimes they ask low because they're trying to get the Congress to work on things they don't have quite so much of a heart for. But it's not health. Health, they know Congress wants to fund. So, for example, USAID's health programs have risen from $1 billion a year in 2000 to over $4 billion this year. That's just health. A lot of that goes through the Global Health Bureau, but a lot of it does not. A lot of it goes through the regional bureaus at USAID. Now that's the first thing I want to say. Development's up in general. The second thing is really quite surprising. As much as the story is interesting about spending more money on development than in the past as far as the USG goes, what's really startling is that much more money from other sources is going abroad as well. And in fact, if you go back three or four decades and you look at a pie chart of all the foreign assistance of one sort or another that goes from the United States abroad, it really would have looked like 70-80% of it was from the United States government. In fact, that's what most people assume is the case. Foreign assistance means taxpayer dollars, means USAID, means development in general. That's not the story today. You look at a pie chart of money going abroad that in some way helps other countries, and you're going to find that it's exactly reversed. And maybe 70 or 80% of the money is no longer from the United States government. We've gone way up in the United States government. They've gone up much, much more in terms of the amount of money that's going abroad. Now, what are those categories? I sent a phone message a couple hours ago to somebody who helped write this these comments up, and I asked him for clarification on one point. There may be somebody here who knows what that clarification would be, but that 70 or 80% that is not USG funded includes things like, this is the phrase that I wasn't sure about, fixed capital investments. Remittances, I understand, that's people who are over here and, you know, send their money back to help their families back home. It's a huge amount of money. From the poorest sector of our society, billions go back to Latin America, Africa, Asia, wherever they come from, to help those countries. Then you've got the foundations, the philanthropic organizations, the NGOs, the faith-based groups, the educational associations, huge amounts of money go abroad. You know, in the 19th century, probably the most astute foreign observer of the United States was Alexis de Tocqueville, who in 1835 and 1840 wrote two volumes about American democracy. And he noted then something that is still true today, which is absolutely unusual about the United States. Unbelievable development of the non-governmental sector. Civil society is extremely powerful here. And sometimes you'll get these arguments going on between the United States and Europe with respect to how much of our gross national product as a percentage we spend on development. We were at one point 22nd out of 22 in terms of the percentage of USG money in terms relative to our national wealth that goes for development. It's actually, in the last 5 or 6 years, changed quite a bit. Percentage is going up, but it's still relatively low compared to the Nordic countries, et cetera. What all of that leaves out, of course, is that most of our foreign assistance doesn't come from the United States government. It comes from this vibrant, private, philanthropic part of the United States scene. And it's one of the most unusual things of a Western democracy is what goes on here relative to that. So that's the second thing I want you to understand, is that when you think of assistance abroad, do not just think of the United States. And the third thing I want to suggest to you has to do with what's happened, not just in terms of increased money from the United States government over the last few years, but something that I'll call this the Powell-Natsios agenda. When Secretary Powell was being considered to be Secretary of State, he was before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he basically took an idea of Andrew Natsios, administrator of USAID, and put it forward as something he was going to push. It was called GDA, the Global Development Alliance, which was basically a fancy way of saying exactly what this panel's about. It's about how do you leverage U.S. government funds with the private sector to make a difference beyond anything that we could pay for ourselves. It has been an absolute spectacular success. I'll just give you some brief statistics for USAID. Since 2002, the United States USAID has provided about $1.4 billion in 400 of these public-private alliances and leveraged $4.6 billion. So you have over $6 billion that's been expended abroad on the basis of an investment by the United States government of $1.4 billion. Really quite remarkable. And acting Administrator Henrietta Fore has said that she thinks that ought to be tripled in terms of our emphasis on that. In fact, one of our key people has gone to the World Bank to help the World Bank do more of this as well there. It's such a spectacular way to utilize money. Now, to be perfectly frank with you, there's one thing I've never heard addressed on this, and I don't know the answer to it, so I'll just put it out as a question. I would like to ask a question about these 400 public-private alliances. I'd like to know how much the 400 private groups, corporations, whatever they were, I'd like to know what they gave before this. I'd like to know, the U.S. government can't claim that they raised all that money from those groups. I suspect part of what's going on is that we are better cooperating together, and perhaps together we are raising more money from them, but it's not as if these groups weren't doing anything before. A lot of them were doing things before. Paul Emer here, who used to work for USAID for 30 years, worked with Marathon Oil on some projects, and now is doing this in the private sector. USG is not even involved in a project he's involved in right now. In Africa right now, there are a lot of oil companies doing things relative to malaria, sometimes with the USG, sometimes with the President's Malaria Initiative, sometimes on their own. So there's much more of this than the past. And let me add something here. I think it would be true to say, and it'd be interesting what Paul thinks about this, but I would suspect 10 or 15 years ago, the corporate and private industry climate and the climate at USAID wouldn't have necessarily interacted that much. In fact, there might have even been a little bit of hostility. USAID are tree huggers, after all. They're philanthropic sort of people, have long view. And we all know that private corporations are greedy, money, you know. And, you know, it looks like two different worlds. It looked like two different worlds. That is such a remarkably different situation right now. We actually have offices that now that work to support them. I think they were suspicious of USAID as well. You're not all that realistic about what it takes to solve the problems of stock owners and things like that. But now there is a really common understanding that there really is a crossover in agendas that makes a lot of sense. And by the way, let me add something. The interesting thing about people in the private sector who will get involved in charitable causes, I've watched this happen over and over again. It's true. They might do it for some public relations reasons. First, they might set up a little foundation with 1 or 2% of their profits or something. It didn't really cost them that much. They get some good articles in the paper. You know, they're good for the environment and all this. But I've watched these groups. They get involved. They do something. And you know what? It makes them feel good. They like it. It makes sense. They look for a partner to do it with. And the next thing you know, they're spending a higher percentage of their profits on this sort of thing because they're decent people often who, once they see they can make a difference, they're quite attracted to doing it. It's the same thing that happens with people at USAID. I ask them, why did you go into USAID in the first place? Why are you doing development work? And two-thirds of them tell me, approximately, it's not a scientific poll, but they often say, after college, I went to the Peace Corps. They thought they were going to spend 2 years abroad, come back, get a job, do whatever they do. But they got hooked on development work. They got hooked on making a difference, and they found themselves giving their lives to it. Same thing happens in other segments as well. So the third thing I want you to understand here is the public-private partnerships with the United States government are much, much bigger than in the past, and there's no reason to think they're not going to go up. And I'll add this. I don't care who wins the next election, whether it's Democrat or Republican or which candidate, I don't see the trend reversing with respect to more and more attention on development. It's a great investment. You can be a conservative or a liberal and support it. It makes good sense to do it. And I'm pleased that that's so much more the climate than it was 5 or 10 years ago. How am I doing here? Let me just give you a few examples of how this actually works in practice, because it's really quite interesting. In a lot of ways, this isn't new to USAID. Long before 2001, long before Andrew Natsios and Secretary Powell, from the late 1980s, there was a real attempt by USAID to develop new technologies in health, nutrition, family planning, etc. And as a result of spending really millions, in some cases I think actually billions of dollars over quite a few years, a whole series of innovations were developed in cooperation with the private sector, which have changed the lives or saved the lives of millions of people abroad. I'm talking about things like the safe injection technologies. I'm talking about rehydration therapy, the use of zinc, the use of vitamin A, all of these technologies that save lives and don't cost that much money. We've been doing that for a very long time. But let me give you some specific examples of where we make a U.S. government investment along with other international donors and private donors that have a huge impact. Now, I sit on the board of something called GAVI, the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations. We're going to South Africa in about 5 or 6 weeks to have one of our semi-annual meetings. But I think we contribute something like $60 or $70 million. It's a fair amount of money. But they have actually billions to work with, because there's lots of other bilaterals and international organizations and private groups that give money to try to create demand for drugs that the drug companies by themselves wouldn't be able to produce without that demand, and it's making a huge difference. Or take the example of what we're doing now with the Gates Foundation or Coca-Cola or the Rotary or Shell Oil or lots of others. We have multiple projects with these groups. And by the way, Gates is only going to get bigger. As you know, there's other money coming into the Gates Foundation here in the next few years that's going to make that absolutely spectacular and huge. It's not uncommon for me to get a call in my office at Reagan Building for USAID. I remember one day I was having a meeting, the phone rang, I picked it up, and it was the Gates Foundation, and they just said, Kent, we want you to know that in a few hours we're going to make an announcement of some major research we're going to do. I think it was on malaria that day, as I recall. And they had decided what to do based on what we were doing, what we were not doing. We make decisions together about how to divide the work up because there's so much to do. Great relationship with the Gates folks, and this is true for other organizations as well. as well. Or take YAVI, the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative. USAID contributes a lot to that, but so do a lot of other folks. And there's so many things I'd like to tell you about. One of the most spectacular programs we have right now, the President announced a year and a half ago, the President's Malaria Initiative, $1.2 billion, 15 Africa countries, reduce mortality in those 15 countries by about 50%. And a lot of it is, and the President said, you must do this in cooperation with the private sector. Indeed, it's been probably as successful as any thing we've done. And the mortality rates for children under 5 and others are going down at a spectacular rate in Tanzania and other places where we're rolling out these interventions. So that's extremely encouraging as well. We have something called Banking on Health, which allows us to work with financial institutions to get them to lend money to the health sector to do their work. I'll mention something since Peter was talking about India that I think is kind of interesting as well. I went down to Uttar Pradesh, which is south of, it's like a country. I mean, it's like 170 million people for that one state of India. Many of the world's poor live in that area. 70% probably live on $1 or $2 a day, for their needs. And what we're doing there is we're giving vouchers to people to go to private clinics. We're doing this with the government. They take the voucher, they're pregnant, and they go to the private clinic, get their treatment, have the baby delivered, do their various care, and then the government reimburses them for this. The government loves this. They don't mind that it's often the private sector that is provided. It's just like Peter said, much of the assistance really is provided by the private sector. We're doubling and sometimes tripling their work. The prices come down for the services provided. They use the vouchers, and the system is really working quite well. We did the same thing with rehydration projects, safe drinking water projects with Procter & Gamble. I'm going to skip through a lot of these. HHS does a project or two in various places and that have to do with laboratories. And I'm just going to rush through to my conclusion so that you folks can hopefully have some questions near the end. I have three quick conclusions I draw from all of this. First of all, as I mentioned at the outset, development's going up, and it's going to continue to go up, and health is going to be a huge part of that. This is a good time to be in the health business if you care about people around the world. Now, number two about this, I don't see any reason why it will not go up significantly enough that we're going to run out of the right kind of people and entities to do this. We're going to have to really think about how to do this, but whatever we get, it will not be enough. We've got to cooperate better. We need to do more public-private initiatives because the needs are so great out there. And so we really need to do that. And third, public-private partnerships are going to be a big, big part of this. And I think the scene is set for some really remarkable success there, and that's why I was pleased to come and participate in this panel, because I believe in the work of the champion. So thanks.
Thank you.